This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. From time to time, we check in with mayors of communities here in Northwest Indiana, in particular dealing with the pandemic, how they're dealing in their particular communities with the pandemic. Today, we happen to have Hobart Mayor Brian Snedeker with us. And Mayor Snedeker, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be with you, Chris.
Well, since the pandemic really hit hard, and of course then after that came right away after that, is when the stay-at-home orders and businesses had to close came in back in March. How has the city of Hobart been able to deal with the situation, and where do things stand right now?
Yeah, we took a pretty aggressive response to it when we started realizing this was something that communities was going to have to prepare for and plan ahead. We quickly got together our leadership team and initiated steps, everything from employees working for the city. Certainly there had to be some furloughs for part-time employees, and then employees that could work remotely. We implemented some programs for that where they could continue to work and work from their computers at home. We also understood that police and fire have to continue to do their job along with public works. So we equipped our departments with PPE that could give protection. Our ambulance services, they put together a plan where if there was a call that was COVID, symptoms, then they would suit up, mm-hmm. and only certain individuals would go inside the structure to take the person, if need be, to the hospital. And then our police department, certainly they had PPE available to them. As you know, it's not always the easiest thing in the world to wear a mask or PPE in an emergency response. Sometimes you don't have a chance to do it and prepare. But I will say that as a community, we have fared very, very well. We've had a very low positive rate within our employees. We have about 250 employees. Mm-hmm. And I believe we're in single digits as far as positives. As a community, we have also fared fairly well. We've worked closely with St. Mary's Community Healthcare, and we've had ongoing during like March and April, we were having weekly meetings with them, and we would remote in from City Hall. And then I also started a program with other mayors in Lake Porter and LaPorte County where I requested that we would come in on a Zoom meeting every Wednesday morning. And that was really a big help to all of us because we shared as mayors what we were doing, what preventions we were doing, how we were handling staffing, how we were handling operations within the city, dealing with our citizens. And that helped immensely. And we also would then coordinate some of the Zoom meetings with the governor's office and other state and federal officials. So we really tried to be a unified front as far as government responses in Northwest Indiana. And so the pandemic has absolutely had an impact financially on communities. Thank goodness the CARES Act is allowing communities, if they can substantiate expenses that they've put out for PPE and other related expenditures, we're able to recover some of that from the federal government. And so I think we still have to be vigilant. This is far from being over, so we have to continue to put in steps.
Now, since the city of Hobart is primarily made up of small businesses, a lot of independent businesses, yeah. Was it really, really rough on them, at least at first, and have they been able to recover as much as they possibly can after having to close down because everything was closed and everybody had to stay at home, for at least for a while?
Yeah, that's a very good question because, as you know, some restaurants decided to close down during the heat of the pandemic, and so what they did, some of them that closed down, they did some remodeling and updates to their building, so they made it purposeful. for them during that time. Some businesses decided to stay open. As you know, our community has a substantial amount of retail and restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the restaurants stayed open, and they actually did very well on their takeout and delivery. Many people, as you know, instead of going to the grocery store every day, they would order out and have it delivered so they didn't have to go out of their homes. So that actually worked to the advantage of a few of the restaurants. Our retail, such as the mall and some of the other retail businesses along the Route 30 corridor, certainly they closed down for periods of time, you know, during March and April and May, and even into June. But when they were able to reopen, some stores weren't able to open right away because they had furloughed their employees, and getting staffing back in place took some time. In fact, I was with the mall manager, and we were talking, and he was giving some success stories on some of the businesses and how they've done very well. The mall has been closing at 7 o'clock, and so they're open for 8 hours, and how that has helped many of the stores in their scheduling of employees, and how during those 8 hours, some of the stores have been doing a phenomenal amount of business. So I think the recovery is coming. I think there's some businesses and retail that are still getting back to maybe where they were before the pandemic. But I think we still have, you know, we still have a ways to go, because we know this pandemic is not, it's still present,
mm-hmm.
and we still have to have safeguards in place. We are still being very careful, like in City Hall. Employees as well as people visiting City Hall are expected to have their face coverings on while they're in the public hallways and public areas of the building. So we still believe that preventative measures do need to be exercised.
Well, it sounds like that the City of Hobart is prepared to continue on as best possible with the situation. Are the residents, as best as you can get in your input with them, find out what they're facing, and they let you all know that you're doing the best you can with what you have to work with right now?
Yes. The public has responded very well. Now, I will tell you, as you know, this has been going on for several months. There are some people that are, you know, frustrated with the face coverings and those types of PPE requirements. And some people do not believe they should be wearing the face coverings. And to some degree, we respect that. You know, we're not going to take steps to create any kind of enforcement efforts. We encourage it. But we also understand people do have to make decisions for themselves. Now, I will tell you that there's still a lot of stores, especially in the mall, where you can't enter their store without having a face covering.
Yeah, I've discovered that myself, yes.
Yes.
It's interesting.
And so many stores are requiring that, which I think is a good preventative measure. But, you know, through this whole thing, I have encouraged people to get outside, to enjoy the fresh weather of the spring and summer, enjoy the lakefront, you know, keep social distancing and wear a mask if in situations where you may need to. But I've always encouraged people to get out and still exercise, because, you know, for people to lock themselves in their home for 3 or 4 months, that is not good either mentally or from a physical standpoint. And so I've encouraged people to still get out and exercise and use good judgment. But I think our community has responded well during this time.
Mayor Santa Curry, we know that when you first ran for mayor 13 years ago, you ran as a Democrat. You've been a Democrat as a mayor since then, but just recently you've decided, after I guess a lot of thought and consideration, that you changed affiliation in parties from the Democrat to Republican. There were reasons, and you mentioned that, I guess, when you made your announcement at Festival Park about this. What were your concerns, and are your concerns now, that made you decide to switch from a Democrat to a Republican?
Let me first say, Chris, that I work with amazing people. I work with some amazing Democrats, work with some amazing Republicans. So my decision was not based on anything to do with local relationships and local operations or local politics.
Mm-hmm.
My decision was based on what I felt like nationally I could no longer stand in a unified front with. I have been a Democratic mayor now for 12 and a half years. I was a police chief before I became mayor, and I supported the Democratic mayor while I was police chief. But there comes a time when you have to look at what is going on in this nation. And I have to make a decision as a mayor, and I have to be responsive to myself and to my family and to those that have supported and those that I represent. And I'm not trying to necessarily change anybody's political viewpoints. That's something they have to review and they have to determine for themselves. But for me in my home, I felt that I had to take a stand on what I felt was representative of my personal convictions. And also, not just my convictions, but what I felt as a nation I could not agree with the Democratic Party nationally. And so I made that decision that I felt that the Republican Party, you know, sometimes people think you change a part to a party, you're automatically lockstep with everybody in that party. You know, when I made that decision, I made a change to the Republican Party. And I felt that the party's principles and basic views nationally was more in line with my views, my morals, and my principles. And so I made the decision. Was it made lightly? 12 and a half years as a Democratic mayor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was through months of considering what I felt was best.
Do you think that now that you made the switch in political parties, that you feel that what is currently in the administration with Governor Holcomb and Lieutenant Governor Crouch, that their thoughts and views, their principles are closer to yours?
I do commend Governor Holcomb. I think that he's done some really good things for Northwest Indiana. I think that he has understood the importance of Lake County and Northwest Indiana as a whole. I don't think that governors in the past, some of them, have always been as quick to understand the importance of what Northwest Indiana brings to the rest of the state, and so I commend him in his efforts. I think that he understands that working across the aisle is how you get things accomplished, and I'm a big believer in that. I don't believe in making decisions based on party affiliation. I think what you have to do is represent the people that you've been elected to represent, and be a consensus builder. Get things done. And that's what I've always tried to use as my philosophy in going forward.
Well, Mayor Snedeker, thank you for spending time with us and explaining in great detail your feelings and concerns that made you first decide to make the change of political affiliation. And thank you for the update on how the community of Hobart is dealing with the pandemic. We appreciate your comments today.
Thank you, Chris.
That's Hobart Mayor Brian Snedeker, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, it's another statement to say that back to school this year in Indiana, and Northwest Indiana in particular, is unusual and filled with uncertainty. And that is the way that Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, begins the latest missive that's out there. Let's find out more about it. Tammy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's certainly true that this is not a usual time for young people and is full of uncertainty for young people and as well as for grown-ups, isn't it?
It is. It is. And at the same time, as hard as it is for all of us, really it's our ability as community leaders, teachers, educators, families, it's our ability to model tolerance for that uncertainty that can really help our kids.
I know that this is the opportunity, I guess, to learn something, hopefully learn something from the pandemic and the impact it's had. It's just that it's so difficult to try to do the traditional ways of teaching people and young people in particular, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think we've all been challenged and experienced with what are those non-traditional ways, right? Is it hybrid model of you know, digital and still paper things? How does that look? And yet, the more we can explore those new ideas, the better off that's going to be, and the more we can bring some new information and that education to our kids.
I know it's very, very important for young people to know something positive coming out of an outcome of something has happened, because it's just these are good interactions to have. Young people normally get them through the traditional methods when things are as they usually are. They're just not getting them now because of COVID-19.
Right. And so peer interaction is part of their education and learning, right? And so most of that peer interaction happens at school. And if your school's virtual, how are you going to get those peer interactions? So making sure that we're trying to figure out ways for, one, if it's in a class, you know, have discussions and interactions and, you know, viewing parties or shared discussions, you know, that sometimes we can't, we just don't have the building to have that in right now. But it's really important that we can keep that sense of connectivity and civic engagement and community engagement that's usually with the building, but it doesn't have to be.
Mm-hmm. I know that the IYI keeps a close track of what happens in communities all across the Hoosier State, and we're all finding, I guess, from the data and from some actual experiences that have been reported back, that this is a time of isolation for young people as well as for teenagers too. How are they trying to deal with the fact that schools aren't opened the way that they normally would have it, and what impact are we seeing on the other things that are not good, like child abuse and neglect coming out of all this?
Right. Well, we do know, again, that child abuse and neglect is really frequently first reported by educators, and mm-hmm. they're trained to look for those warning signs. And so, again, you know, we're trying to, there's some education, some tools available to help that remotely. Or one of the things that we're hearing from both the educators, but also a lot from the kids, is they want those just quick check-ins, those one-to-one, hey, how you doing, right? What's going on? And that can be just a few minutes. It doesn't have to be long appointment. It doesn't have to be formal. But those one-to-one check-ins can really make a big difference, because you're not able to do those kind of informal check-ins in the classroom right now.
Don't after-school programs offer that opportunity, too, for educators to kind of keep an eye on the youngsters?
You bet. You bet. And we know that you're absolutely right, Chris. So much education takes place outside of the classroom as well. So sports, camps, community centers, youth groups, all of that kind of thing, where those adults lean in and help, you know, the students with their daily life and all of those things. Some of those are still going on in adapted formats. Some of them have moved virtually, and some of them are on a pause right now. So really talking about and thinking about what services are available, promoting those, and making sure that we're looking for kids that might not have one of those connection points, and how can we make that available? You know, if maybe they used to get that through a club after school and that club's not meeting right now, maybe we need to try to engage them with, you know, Boys and Girls Club or something along those lines that may have an alternate virtual program.
What kind of ways are we able to keep track of the issues that we know affect young people as well as adults, the economic, the racial disparities that make it difficult, particularly for education purposes? What are we able to be able to try and maintain or improve those inequities, I guess, is what I'm trying to think of.
You're absolutely right. Those inequities, we knew they existed. They existed long before COVID-19, right? And at the same time, the current pandemic has highlighted and accentuated, particularly kids that are living in communities of color, immigrant populations, low-income families. We really need to make sure we are keeping our eye on those kids and families right now and making sure that, we're asking ourselves continually, how do we need to reach kids that may have extra barriers in their way? How are we adapting our services? Making sure that we're not going to lose a whole bunch of kids and that we're not, and by lose, I just mean their interests, their passions, their motivations, you know, that kind of thing. We want to make sure that we're still paying attention and knowing what we knew before and leaning in and trying to do a little bit more, which sounds hard in a pandemic, and yet the payoff, and it's really such a worthwhile use of time and energy.
Yeah. Now, what does the IYI recommend to parents and to educators to help keep kids on track, so to speak?
Right. So try to contain that sense of and maintain that sense of normalcy. You know, the school structure, if it's a new school structure, just stick with it and try to lean into it and champion it. At the same time, we know that our teachers and our youth service providers are just doing heroic work right now. So build them up, promote them. Even if you're really frustrated, don't share that with your child. Again, help them to be as adaptive and to lean in. And it's okay to say we don't know what's going on, but we're going to try to do our best, and we're all in this together, and we can keep moving forward.
Well, Tammy Silverman, thanks for being with us and for the advice and the observations of ways that we can, as we try to start a new school year, to help youngsters make it in with whatever way they happen to be learning these days because of the pandemic.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. This is Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The LaPorte County Public Library has come up with an interesting way that, because we don't have quite the hands-on experience in the classrooms, at least not for a while, many of the school corporations are not allowing in-person learning, at least to start the semester, because of the coronavirus pandemic. The LaPorte County Public Library has a way to be able to take the experiences to a student. And we're talking about a mobile classroom. And to find out more about it, we have the library's community engagement manager, Susan Banwart. Susan is the lead manager on this project, and thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to talk with you about it.
Well, these are tough times for everybody and for education in particular, and especially as we try to get a new school year started. Tell us the idea behind the mobile classroom, how you came up with the design, or at least helped out on the design of the facility, and what students and anybody, for that matter, I suppose, that takes advantage of it will really get to learn.
This idea has been bouncing around here in our organization for a good number of years now, and we really got serious about it in 2018. We were very fortunate that we had several private donors and also an opportunity to apply for a grant. So the funding for the entire project was through donations and a grant. And What really has been a tipping point for us to decide to really go forward and move forward and implement this opportunity in our community is some data that we had seen through the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the National Assessment of Educational Progress. So when we looked at Bureau of Labor Statistics, at the 30 occupations that were projected to grow the most in the next 10 years, more than 60% of those occupations are in the STEM and healthcare fields.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then when we looked at the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, that was telling us that only 30% of students in the United States were prepared for college-level science courses or for a career in STEM. And so we here have been having developing STEM-related programming for several years, and we thought, how can we get more of this information and an opportunity to schools? And so the mobile classroom was something that we said we're going to, you know, we're going for it. We've got funding and opportunities for funding here, and so we got the ball rolling, and now we finally have it here.
Describe for us what this mobile classroom looks like, and how did you and all the folks that have worked on the project come up with this design?
So this actually is a type of vehicle that's not, it's becoming more and more common. So we were fortunate that we had national and regional organizations that have a similar vehicle. So mm-hmm. we've got the Ethos Foundation over in Elkhart County, and they have a mobile classroom. And then Warsaw Public Schools also has a mobile science bus. So we were able to go and visit and tour those and talk to those people. And then further, there's an international association called the Mobile Laboratory Coalition. And that gave us an even further understanding of what's happening all over the world with mobile STEAM education. So we developed a plan for this classroom based on being able to go out and see different examples of what works in different communities. And so this vehicle is 38 foot long. Really looks like a large RV that you see on the road, you know, yeah. that people vacation in. So it's on a Winnebago platform. And so it's 38 feet long, and it has, instead of the typical inside that you would see in a motorhome, it has seven workstations. So they're like desks with bench seats, and you slide into there. And then there's a large monitor on the other side of the vehicle that's a smart screen monitor. So it's touch screen, and our library instructor can present content there. And then the technology on there is we can bring out based on the lesson that we may be out in the community teaching. So that's kind of what it looks like.
Have you tried to design this mobile classroom not only with the ways to be able to for students to be able to see the coursework, but also to be able to experience some of the equipment, the techniques that they're liable to find if they go out there in some factory or business in LaPorte County?
Yes, that's right. So in our county, 19% of the workforce is in manufacturing. And mm-hmm. so we really wanted to look at ways to expose students to the career opportunities available locally and regionally. And so things that we have in there relate to advanced manufacturing concepts like, some subtractive manufacturing, automation, rapid prototyping, and quality control are some of the main focuses we have on there. So we have a CNC milling machine. We have a laser cutter engraver. We have digital microscopes. We have a vinyl cutting machine. We also have Google Expeditions, which are very interesting because through Google Expeditions, you can tour things like the Subaru plant that's down by Lafayette.
Oh, yeah.
Virtually. So all these types of hands-on lessons that students can engage in while they're on the vehicle are things that we couldn't necessarily lend to schools that take training. They're not exactly easy to just, loan out easily as some of our other things that we loan out to schools are. So by having these on the mobile classroom, we can go to a school, we can let students come aboard, experience the hands-on learning that takes place, and give them ideas that could help them understand pathways they might take in their learning that can result in, great jobs right here in our local area and region.
We're talking with Susan Benwart. She is the Community Engagement Manager for the LaPorte County Public Library about the library's new mobile classroom that is actually out there and able to be used. Now, Susan, tell me if they have obviously had input from local businesses and industries in wanting to get this set up. Have you gotten any feedback from any of them about what they might have seen if they've toured the mobile classroom?
Well, yeah, it's been a challenge this year, of course. A lot of the community events that we had planned on attending and company type events that were planned locally have been canceled or postponed. So it has been somewhat of a challenge to be able to get out and do some of the things that we had hoped to be able to do this year. And that's just the reality that we're in right now. So what we've been trying to do is show how the vehicle works in through video and through some smaller class groups that can come through it. So we've done some online meetings and things like that to give people an idea. And overall, the feedback, you know, people are very excited to see this get implemented this school year. We're looking forward to seeing how students are interacting and take that feedback back and adapt our plans and move on from there.
Well, sounds like if things improve and we get hands-on experience back with us again, this is going to be a great opportunity for students to be able to pick up the STEAM knowledge that they need to be able to find those high-paying jobs out there.
I believe it will, and I think it's a great way and opportunity in our community. And I do think because in our county, in our service district for the library, you know, we're uniquely situated to be able to offer this opportunity to multiple school corporations within our county. So that helps us give access to students across our community, and we're really looking forward to being able to do that over the next many years.
Well, Susan, thank you for the great information, and it sounds like it's a great addition to not only the LaPorte County Public Library's items that can be out there to help put some education into hands for folks in LaPorte County, but just in general, it's going to be some great jobs, I'm sure, that will come from the experiences that the students that take advantage of this will have. Thank you for talking about today.
Thank you very much.
Susan,
it was a pleasure.
Susan Banwart is with the LaPorte County Public Library.
Indiana Landmarks has just announced the latest 10 most endangered list. It's the annual list that the organization puts out about Hoosier landmarks that are in jeopardy. And this year's list includes, among other buildings and sites, two schools that provided some unprecedented learning opportunities for African Americans. In fact, one of them is in Lake County. It's Gary Roosevelt High School, or as it's always known, as Dear Old Roosevelt. At least to Tommy Williams it is, and to a lot of other people too. And with us to talk about the 10 most endangered list in general, and in particular about the Gary Roosevelt High School being on the list this year, we have Brad Miller. He's the director of the Indiana Landmarks Northwest Indiana Field Office. And as always, Brad, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
Will you first give us an idea about the 10 most endangered list and why it is called the 10 most endangered list? What classifies a building site or a location somewhere in Indiana as being endangered?
Well, certainly, yeah. We've been putting up the list since 1991, and we hope to use this listing to draw attention to landmarks across the state that we see as in need of our attention. What constitutes endangered could be a building on the verge of collapse, a building or place that's slated for demolition, or in this case in Roosevelt, where it's a building that's fairly stable and structurally sound, but has recently been found without a use. So what happens to Roosevelt now that its doors are closed, the students have left, and what's the next step? And that's what we're hoping to do with our listing, is draw attention to that need. Roosevelt is certainly a building with a storied past, being constructed in 1930 and being a hallmark of Black excellence in the city of Gary. And we just hope to raise that attention and help in the process of finding a new use or owner.
I know that one of the things that makes what is actually known as Theodore Roosevelt High School, or as everybody here knows, Gary Roosevelt, stand out is that I guess there are only three high schools like it in the state. And it just happens to be that one of them is up here in Northwest Indiana. Where are the others that are around that you know?
Yeah, so the three high schools that were built specifically for African-American students was Crispus Attucks in Indianapolis, and then Lincoln in Evansville. So Gary Roosevelt has the title of those three being the third one constructed, and certainly an important part of our history that needs to be told.
I guess that Roosevelt High School was one of the largest in the Midwest, so that means that there may have been more students at Gary Roosevelt High School than even at Crispus Attucks, huh?
Yeah, probably. And when it first started, it was actually served the K through 12 students of the city of Gary, so it was quite the place.
What are some of the things that you and your colleagues with Indiana Landmarks make a note of. You talk about the physical conditions of a building, which is how it ends up on the 10 most endangered list. Some of them for more lists than just one. This happens to be this year, I guess, Roosevelt's first on the list, first time on the list. But are there any other things that you keep an eye on in particular when you're told about a building that may be in danger of either falling apart or just maybe has to be demolished? There's just no way you can save it. What things do you look for in particular?
Well, I think certainly, you know, at the end of the day, most buildings can be saved. It's just a matter of one, the cost of it, and two, what's the use of that building after it's stabilized and preserved.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're looking at Roosevelt, which we know is still in good shape. But now the next steps are, you know, what's going to take its place? What's going to fill those classrooms and gym and swimming pool? What are those uses going to be down the road? And how are we going to find the funds to support that and sustain it over time? So those are after the building, we know the building's good. So now it's just the use.
Who approached Indiana Landmarks about the building? Was it just residents in Northwest Indiana and former graduates of dear old Roosevelt, or was it the folks that are really in charge of the place right now, the people that took over the facility from the Gary Community School Corporation, MGT Consulting Group? Who first tipped you all off to this?
Well, I think certainly our office has been involved for a long time. Driven by the great alumni groups of Roosevelt. We previously assisted them in getting it listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and they're fearless advocates for the building, as well as, you know, just a community acceptance and knowledge that this place is special for its history of academics and athletics. So there's no question that it meets all the criteria of what we see as an Indiana landmark. It's a meaningful place to the people of Gary. And also, as you know, just a unique history, a well-known school architect, William Itner out of St. Louis, and a position as one of the many high schools in Gary that made the school system internationally renowned for the way it was teaching the youth of Gary.
We're talking with Brad Miller. He's the director of Indiana Landmarks Northwest Field Office, which is based out of the Miller neighborhood of Gary. Indiana Landmarks has announced the 10 most endangered list, the annual list of Hoosier landmarks that are in jeopardy. And on the list for the first time is Gary Roosevelt High School. What kinds of things were the people at MGT, the people in the emergency management team, as they're sometimes called, have told you about that are problems in the building that they feel they can't necessarily resolve, but they would like to be able to put it up for some maybe a public-private partnership to take care of?
Certainly, yeah. I think we know from previous reports in 2019, the polar vortex caused multiple failures of the heating system, so a lot of pipes burst and a lot of interior water damage. That was isolated in certain parts of the school. And with that, obviously, with water also sometimes comes mold. But they're relatively small challenges, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked very closely with the leadership of MGT just to stay apprised of the school's condition. And then also, I know they are dedicated to finding a new use or users or owner or owners for the property to make sure that we can preserve this landmark and have it continue to serve the city of Gary.
From your knowledge with Indiana Landmarks, buildings that are on the endangered list in the past and how they've been worked on, what are some ideas or possibilities that a building like Roosevelt High School might go through? And what are some other examples, maybe of not school buildings elsewhere in the state, but buildings of its kind in the state, big buildings that have housed thousands of people, in this case students, what have they been able to turn them into here to get them off the list?
Well, yeah, we've certainly had a lot of schools on our 10 most endangered list over the years, from rural one-room schoolhouses to, you know, full college campuses. In the case of 2 years ago at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer, you know, these large public high schools really lend themselves to a number of uses, such as housing. It could be small businesses, community center. Obviously, Roosevelt still has a pool. It still has gyms, an auditorium. So I think in this case, it's not just going to be one big use, but certainly the things I mentioned can contribute to maybe a whole campus of uses and hopefully things that, again, will be beneficial to the surrounding neighborhood, to the city, and for the size of the building, to the region.
Indiana Landmarks, Northwest Field Office Manager and Director, Brad Miller. And thank you, Brad, for being with us to talk about the fact that Gary Roosevelt is the latest on the 10 most endangered list for this year. And we hope that there's some good news that comes out here in the future.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was a pleasure.
The list includes two schools that have provided unprecedented learning opportunities for African Americans, and Gary Roosevelt High School is one of them. This is Richly Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us on our program today. If you happen to have missed any of the local segments, we put together a podcast that you can hear on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, after we're done. And hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Regionally Speaking.